tomorrow. Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greetings, friends around the world. It sounds strange, but the best way to discourage the spread of nuclear weapons among developing nations is for the United States to be the chief exporter of atomic reactor fuel. Try to figure that one out. We're saying, at the one hand, that there are about 40 nations ready to join the nuclear club, that about 40 countries may acquire enough plutonium by 1985, each able to make a few bombs of the low-yield kiloton or so range of the type that destroyed Hiroshima and Nagasaki at the ushering in of the nuclear age in 1945. 40 countries. Who would those countries be? Well, when you answer that question, you begin to get just a little bit nervous. They would include some of the Arab countries, Pakistan. They would include some of the other countries in a world where you and I both wish they would never get their hands on any kinds of weapons because of irrationality and because of the unbelievable type of governments you see in charge of some of those countries. And I think right now one of the most outstanding, if that's the word to use, perhaps infamous is better, examples is the country of Uganda under a great toadish gas bag called Idi Amin. Did you hear of the absolute unbelievable brutality of the rape of the university? Because an almost illiterate kid of his, whom the Russians could only keep for a month when he tried to send him up to the Soviet Union to learn aeronautical engineering, the kid couldn't even read or write, apparently. They sent him back to Uganda. He swaggers around the university there, with armed bodyguards, of course, trying to, maybe I shouldn't say that, but anyway, his overtures toward the co-eds became rather notorious. They didn't like it. The other students couldn't stand him. He went back home to Big Dada and apparently voiced a little bit of irritation over the reception he was getting at the university. So the other day, the troops arrived and started killing people. They raped a lot of the women. One report had it that they shot over 100, totally destroyed the university. The students simply, those that remained, drifted away. It apparently looks like a ghost town now. Here was the leading university, of which Idi Amin, who is a dictator in the black African nation of Uganda, himself, I understand, virtually illiterate, and he was the chancellor of the university. So he sent his armed troops in there and shot the place to pieces. The troops raped a lot of the girls, and those who resisted had their breasts slashed with bayonets, according to eyewitness accounts filtering out of Uganda. Now, what do you do when you live in a country like that and you're one of the citizens? They don't have the ability to do anything about it. Apparently, in countries such as the Sudan, where you read recently of people by the dozens being stood up against the wall and shot, because of an abortive attempt to overthrow some type of a stifling government. That's the only thing you can do in a country like that, and the risks are rather enormous, aren't they? So unless or until some of the trusted henchmen of Big Daddy Idi Amin manage to shove his bloated corpse into the river someplace, which is probably what's going to happen to him eventually, that kind of despotism, of militarism, of anarchism, of utter bestial brutality will continue in country after country. And, of course, it seems that is exactly what many people would like to see occur in many other nations in Africa, since they're trying to complete the process of the dismantling of the former colonial empires and to see to it that some of the domestic governments can come to charge. It is a little chilling, then, when you realize that among those 40 nations by the mid-1980s possessing nuclear weapons, that nuclear weapons may find their way into the hands of just such men as Idi Amin. Could you imagine what the whole world will be like with absolute madmen slavering at the mouth like so many rabid dogs with nuclear weapons in their hands? I mean, a man who would send his troops into a helpless, unarmed university to absolutely shoot it to ribbons because his boy was miffed over his reception on the campus, possessing nuclear weapons. Can you believe what kind of a world it's going to be with India and Pakistan both having the bomb, Israel and Syria, Egypt and Saudi Arabia, countries along the midsection of Africa, the East African islands, Kenya, Uganda, perhaps, Angola, perhaps, a Soviet-dominated state now, communist. Can you imagine what the world is going to be like with nuclear reactors dotting the landscape in countries such as this? Well, Henry Kissinger just recently returned from a talk with the Pakistani officials in trying to prevent the spread of further nuclear weapons in the world because he didn't want the French to go ahead with their goal of building a nuclear reactor in Pakistan. The French aren't too excited about that. Henry Kissinger, of course, is being kept conveniently out of the way. It's better than sewing his lips shut, or muzzling him, I guess, during the presidential election year, and they don't want any high-profile Henry right now, and so Washington is keeping Henry as far out of the scene, as far away, and as far abroad as they can get him. But in the meantime, his name surfaced in the news recently when he came back from Pakistan after trying to negotiate with that government to see if they couldn't perhaps look toward the United States for the provision of fuels instead of building a nuclear reactor on their soil constructed by the French government. He then went to France and stayed at a private home of a friend somewhere not too distant from Paris, but was not there officially in spite of the fact that he apparently was trying to make inroads to some officials in France to try to see if the French wouldn't cancel the deal. The French indicated they're going to go ahead anyway. So on the one hand, we voice fear that the spread of nuclear weapons is going to make the world an increasingly dangerous place. And on the other hand, the United States seems to think the best way to stop all of this is for us to become the chief nuclear power reactor fuel supplier. There's quite a battle now over exports of enriched uranium to India and to other nations. India, of course, exploded a weapon. They didn't call it a bomb. They just call it a nuclear device of some sort, and the Indian newspapers, the Indian government, the ambassador to the United States wanted to emphasize to the whole free world that it was not a bomb. Now, I don't know what in the world you would call it when the dumb thing blows up. It seems to me it's a bomb. It doesn't matter whether it's in a paper bag, a lead pipe, or some nuclear device. If it blows up, I don't care what they call it, it's a bomb. Now, with India having a bomb, and the neighbor, and they hate each other, of Pakistan having the bomb, can you imagine what the world is going to be like? China has the bomb. See, the Soviet Union armed to its nuclear teeth. The United States, the Soviet Union, able to obliterate themselves dozens of times over, and the whole world about 20 to 50 times over, depending upon who you argue with. France has the bomb. Britain, the bomb. I mean, we're talking about nuclear countries all over the world now, small little states, some of them under despotism and military anarchism, who will come to possess nuclear weapons. Well, the Atomic Industrial Forum has said that the United States and other nuclear nations should sell fuel and atomic waste reprocessing services to countries wanting to build atomic power reactors. And they claim that such a policy would reduce the need for other nations to develop their own uranium enrichment and fuel reprocessing plants, which could be used to produce nuclear weapons. And that would then let the United States government impose safeguards to prevent American-supplied reactor fuel from being used in weapons. You know, it's hard to imagine what the world is going to be like in 1985, 1992. But as you view the future, let's take a look at the recent past. How many people in this world could have guessed, even in August of 1973, that by October and November of 1973, we would be plunged into the deepest part of an energy crisis, of absolute shocking runaway inflation, of business recession and stagnation, the throttling of the flow of vital fuels to all of the industrialized world, basically, France, West Germany, Britain, Holland, all of Europe, the United States, the Arab oil embargo imposed after the Yom Kippur War of the autumn of 1973. And suddenly the entirety of the world was thrown into an economic disaster from which we are just now gradually beginning to see a little bit of the hopeful signs of an upturn. Now, in the meantime, just like milking the goose that lays the golden egg, but being careful not to put, you know, the old girl under such a strain that you force feed it to where you're getting an egg and a half every now and then, shaped like an hourglass because of the strain, the Arabs have decided that as they see a little bit of an upturn in the American economy and others, they want to impose huge oil price hikes. And many of the members of the OPEC oil producers now are talking about a very drastic price increase comparable to the quadrupling of prices that followed the 1973 Arab oil embargo. I'm saying, then, as you look in the recent past, that even heads of state, let alone the little guy on the street and driving the truck and working in the factory, didn't have the faintest idea that the whole world was going to be thrown into a shocking, upside-down economic disaster in a matter of a few months, actually in a matter of days. No one predicted it. If anything, they predicted the exact opposite. Many people said the Arabs would never get together unitedly because the one thing that keeps Israel safe has been the traditional bickering among the Arab nations themselves, their inability to cooperate. Certainly they wouldn't multilaterally, unanimously, use their raw materials as a geopolitical weapon against the West. No one imagined that all the Arabs would unitedly act by imposing an oil embargo and simply choking off the flow of vital resources to the major industrialized countries of the world. But they did it, didn't they? And did they ever learn a lesson? Did they ever decide they were sitting in the driver's seat, right in the saddle, and absolutely in charge of the way the world is today when they got away with it? Now today, we are far more dependent on Arab oil than we were at the beginning of the energy crisis. Our vulnerability to a new Arab oil boycott is still exceedingly serious. I'm telling you that within days, the whole world could come crashing down around your ears. Your known world could so totally change in a matter of days, hours, or moments that it's simply incomprehensible. A new outbreak of violence in the Middle East could bring about another Arab oil embargo. Irritation on the part of any Arab state with the United States and principally the Saudi Arabians. If there is something that is about to happen between the United States government and Saudi Arabians, for example, some way, somehow, in which we would disappoint, anger, irritate the Saudis, then they would withdraw their opposition, and they're the major exporter, and they are now opposing the bid for a big oil price hike by the OPEC nations, the only voice of moderation in the whole screaming mess, apparently. The point is that we used to, in the 60s, have to keep one ear to the ground to find out what would Soviet reaction be with regard to American foreign policy. Today, we got to listen to what's going on in the hallways of Kuwait, Abu Dhabi, Saudi Arabia, and Iran. We are far more vulnerable now to a new Arab oil boycott or any significant price increase. Now, the Shah of Iran claims that the prices of commodities imported into Iran from Western countries have been rising at an enormous rate. Isn't that surprising? Shouldn't that just shock the socks off the Shah? That's a tough one to say. I had to take that a little slower. That should really just shock the daylights out of the old Shah, because, you see, he wouldn't know why in the world all those prices are rising. I mean, why should commodities exported from West Germany or France or Holland or Britain or the United States rise? Just because they were thrown into a 17 to a 23% inflation cycle as a result of the Shah imposing quadrupled oil prices on those nations who have to have the oil to make the industries turn, that shouldn't mean that eventually, as these nations are battling hideous runaway inflation, that the prices of their exports are going to rise. But the Shah is sitting over there just dumbfounded that all of these commodities, trucks, automobiles, buses, steel, building supplies, petrochemicals, coming into his country in his bid for the regaining of lost empire, to build cities, to develop housing and public works, are costing so much. Now, isn't this a crazy, bizarre game? You know, you always hear these people talk about passing it along to the consumer. You know, I mean, if a company experiences some type of price rise in various materials it must buy to produce a commodity, which it then sells to the consumer, the idea seems to be that that company depends upon a certain profit always, of course, greedily hoping to increase that profit margin, not satisfied with the profit the way it is, but under no means could they ever consider taking any percentage less, not one umpteenth of one portion of 1% less profit. Therefore, whatever comes along to bring about a required price increase in the materials needed, take the automotive industry if you wish and talk about steel or vinyl and petrochemicals, which basically vinyl is, of course, used so much in automobile dashboards, tops, and, you know, the seat coverings and all the rest of it. So when those prices come along, they say, well, we can't tolerate that, so we've got to pass that along to the consumer. Who is the consumer? Well, he's the guy that works on the assembly line putting the automobile together, and his wife. They've got to eat bread and milk and eggs and fish and beef and carrots and all that stuff to stay alive, just like the boss and the guy that owns the factory. What a crazy, bizarre, teeter-totter game. Here's the Shah of Iran sitting over there now very loudly insisting that there be a very drastic increase in oil prices, over $11 a barrel now. It used to be about $4 a barrel before the energy crisis and below, because he claims the price of things he's got to buy from the Western democracies is going out of sight. He doesn't seem to realize that his price increase on oil is what put him out of sight. So what they do now is they jack up the price of oil again. Eventually, up goes the price of all the commodities being filtered out of the Western democracies into Iran again. Up goes the price of oil. You know, it's kind of like the little country store I remember as a boy in which there was a pinball machine I used to play. And when I would sell newspapers and every now and then get a few nickels ahead, if I had a few left over after my paper route, I'd go down to the Greyhound bus depot and get a few nickels and go play the pinball machine. Now, in those days, pinball machines were more interesting because they had lots more bumpers and none of these big wide open spaces where it hit about two of them and disappeared down the chute. I mean, the thing bounced around for a while first. The kid could get the enjoyment out of his nickel. They even used to have penny machines when I was a kid. And the scores, well, you would get 100, 200, or 300. And if you got something like, say, 1,000, you got a free game. Sometime when you get a chance, walk by a pinball machine and take a look at it. Now it takes 10,379,000 to get a free game. And every ball that strikes something gives you about, you know, 5,000 or 100,000 or something like that. All it did is add a lot of zeros, because it's more exciting to see that you're getting 10,000 every time the ball hits a little pin instead of 1 or 2 or 10. But it's all relative, and it doesn't make any difference. But that is the way nations play this idiotic game of international finance. What is really important is land, food, shelter, and clothing. The basic ingredients, the basic essentials for human survival. Now, if it costs $10 to buy one egg, but if your standard of living is such that that $10 doesn't mean any more to you than maybe 15 cents, it doesn't really make any difference in the long run. But somehow, at one end of the teeter-totter or the other, everybody seems to think they're going to be on the high side, that they're going to get the jump on it, they're going to be the one to profit. So the Arabs now see that prices go up for all the things they must import to build glittering economies in the middle of the desert. So they say, we've got to talk about increasing prices again. But at least the Saudi Arabians recognize, and some of them recognize, that they could, by force-feeding the goose, so strangle the poor thing on sour mash, they might get square eggs one of these days and kill the goose. Matter of fact, I believe it was one of them that used that analogy, except they used the word hen, but they shouldn't have any reason to know that much about our childhood mythology anyway. Apparently, the oil minister from Saudi Arabia, who's called Sheikh Ahmed Zaki Yamani, said recently that Saudi Arabia, the world's leading oil exporter, will resist an increase of that size, but predicted there will be some kind of an increase in 1977. Now, 1977 is about when very drastic price increases are going to hit this Western world because of severe shortages in foodstuffs, because of terrible droughts, because of the destruction of vegetable crops, because of what has happened in many of the world's leading coffee exporters, where the price of coffee is going to go out of sight, and so there are going to be shocking price rises. That'll result in additional demands for higher wages, strikes and the like, which will hurt and cripple industry. And so it looks like mid-1977 you could again be seeing a very serious business recession. If that's fueled at the same time by shocking increases from the Arabs by big oil price hikes, all I can say is look out in mid-1977, because we will once again be trembling on the brink of a potential worldwide Great Depression, in which the Western nations would become virtually impoverished. It's too finely tuned. It's too delicately balanced. It is just that vulnerable. Now, at least Yamani says that he thinks it's premature to talk now about the percentage, group of reporters at a United Nations press luncheon recently. He said it depends on a variety of factors, including the economic recovery in the West. So he recognizes that they got to play it cool, little by little, hold her hands out, and hope the goose can yet drop another golden egg. He said, we are not going to slaughter the hen that lays the gold eggs. Now, right now, they're paying $11.51 for a 42-gallon barrel of crude. And when he was asked, that is, the Saudi Arabian oil minister was asked, that the reporters would like to know just what would be the increase, whether he thought an increase of more than 10% for 1977 would slow down the economic recovery in the West. He said it depends on the rate of recovery. If it's not good enough, it would. But he said 10% now is different from 10% in 1973. It's higher. So he said, I think there will be an increase, but some OPEC members are thinking of a very drastic increase, somewhat similar to what happened in 1973. And he said, we will resist that. Well, that's nice to see one nation resisting what others, such as the United Arab Emirates, and Iran, Qatar, Kuwait, Libya, Iraq, and some of the others might want to do. But whether or not they will succeed in resisting it at all, or if so for very long, remains to be seen, doesn't it? What I'm telling you is that you can't really know just how long you've got to go on living day to day, enjoying your mechanical toys. We're being told, on the one hand, that by 1980, the per capita ratio of automobiles to human beings in the United States will be so absolutely unacceptable that you can't believe it, without any significant increase in the miles of highways and roads, which, on the other hand, are an absolute environmental menace because they're gobbling up millions of arable acres every single year anyway. But we're going to go right ahead building our mechanical toys, polluting the air, polluting the land, spending ourselves into debt way over our head beyond our means, and doing it by fueling those little monsters with oil imported from Arab countries, so that the United States becomes increasingly hooked like a drug addict to the pusher on the importing of foreign oils. Forget the independence idea. Forget the idea of becoming self-sufficient, self-sustaining. Forget it. Maybe that was a thing that back during the Nixon administration it sounded pretty good, or back during the early part of the Ford administration, we've got to become self-sufficient in oil. We've got to develop vast reserves, kind of like Joseph in Egypt. We've got to weather a bad year. We've got to be able to tell the Arabs, no, we won't pay it, we don't need it, forget it. Well, I don't know if Americans would take to the streets and try to hang the president and shoot up the Congress or something. I don't know if they're that wild about hanging on to their automobiles and all of the personal toys that we have, but I'll guarantee you, anything that threatens the average American family with its two automobiles, that threatens a man from driving the automobile by himself. Look at the furor between the diamond lanes, those that wanted to create automobile clubs and carpools and have interurban transit on bus lines and the like moving along, and try to insist that people double up and use these automobiles more economically. Why, the arguments you can get about that, you see, an automobile is an extension of one's own individual personality. People drive the kind of a car they think is kind of, well, them. Little fiery sports bomb or the great big sedate Cadillac, whichever. Whatever bracket of society in which they feel they either fit or should fit. And an automobile is such a personal thing, such an extension of one's own ego, that most people like to be alone in their automobile. They drive along by themselves. They don't like to be told, look, I want several other people to get in there with you. You ought to share the thing. It's a vehicle for a conveyance. No, it is not. It's an expression of one's personality, one's ego, just like one's automobile could match, let's say, the shade of one's clothes or necktie. I mean, that's the first important toy, that many young teenagers and boys ever receive, is an automobile. At about age 15 or 16, a lot of dads buy their kids an automobile. We're hooked to them. We're hooked to our mechanical toys, to our daily way of life. It's no wonder the Bible talks about how the people of God have worshipped the things which their hands manufacture. But what a crazy game it is that the more we depend upon our mechanical toys, the more we're hooked upon our present way of life of absolute burgeoning incredible affluence, the more we are begging cravenly on our knees before countries who bear us nothing but ill will, who hate America and all that it stands for, and who will take to their streets in rejoicing around bonfires when they hear of our final collapse. In the meantime, we seem to enjoy lying prostrate in the sun with an Arab scimitar over our jugular. We seem to enjoy the idea that now not only has Washington got to keep an ear to the ground wondering what the Russians will think if we do something internationally, but now we got to wonder what the reaction will be in Qatar, in Kuwait, Abu Dhabi, Saudi Arabia, Syria, Libya, Morocco. Not to mention Nigeria, Gabon, Indonesia, Algeria, and Libya. Ah, well. You can forget about us becoming independent because the day of our independence is over. The day when we as American citizens have to virtually go begging to other little nations who want us dead. To ask them, could you please let us enjoy our fun in the sun just a few years longer? It's a day when the United States is becoming sick and craven indeed. We are not independent. We are totally dependent upon the whims of the leaders of governments which cannot be depended upon and which recent history has told us can and do act irrationally. Now, when you look at the whole world becoming fueled with atomic bombs and weapons, with the spread of atomic and nuclear reactors around the world, and at the same time the utter dependency of the United States upon Arab oil, it's about time you began to wonder, where in the world do we head from here? What does it all mean? Is there any explanation for it? Well, yes, there is. The whole program, the whole purpose of humankind, the very meaning of the days in which you live, of these struggles behind the scenes in international finance and commerce, in the geopolitical moves of nation to nation, the forming of power blocks and the dismantling of others, the vying for position on the part of the big nuclear powers, the emergence of the third world countries, what it means to the West, the potential for a United States of Europe coming along, an increased trade war between some of America's own allies and herself. All of this is laid out, believe it or not, in Bible prophecy. Most people would be shocked to realize that the Bible is so up to the moment that it actually portrays exactly what is happening right now, including the flow of much of the world's wealth into Arab coffers in the Middle East and the fact that the Middle East is the most heavily armed region in the world. If you want to write for this booklet, The United States and the British Commonwealth in Prophecy, and also this booklet, How to Understand Prophecy, you will get a real handle on what is the meaning of world events. The number to call is 800-423-4444. The operators are waiting to take your call right now for that booklet on the United States in Prophecy. That's 800-423-4444, or write to me, Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California. Tell us the call letters of your station. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow with Garner Ted Armstrong, sponsored by the Worldwide Church of God. For literature offered on this program, send your requests along with the call letters of this station to Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, 91123. Or you may dial this toll-free number, 800-423-4444.